Welcome to CII's podcast, The Voice of Corporate Governance. While this podcast is open to the public, the majority of our work is only accessible to current CII member organizations. If you would like information on becoming a member of CII, please visit our website at CII.org or contact our Director of Membership, Melissa Fader, with her email, melissa@CII.org. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Welcome, everyone. This is a Council of Institutional Investors educational podcast. I'm Jeff Mahoney, General Counsel of CII. I'm here today with Professor Shivaram Rajapal of Columbia Business School. Professor Rajapal is a co-author of a recent research paper entitled Lifetime Earnings. Welcome back, Professor. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. Thanks for having me again.
Professor, in your recent research paper entitled Lifetime Earnings, you looked at a sample of over 20,000 U.S. public companies for the years 1975 to 2019. What data did you analyze for those companies, and what were some of your key findings from that analysis?
So we started with a fairly simple question. Let's say you buy the entire company at the time the company goes public. So you take the IPO offer price, say multiplied by the number of shares in the company, and you ask, how long does it take before I can recover the price I paid via some kind of payoffs? Like, you know, we use earnings. We've done this with cash flows, et cetera, as well. And the idea was simple. I put $100 down. How long before fundamentals works out in such a way that, you know, I get a return at least equal to the IPO offer price? So that was the motivation or the idea behind the analysis. And along the way, we discovered all kinds of interesting things. So it turns out that if 100 firms go public, about 17 survive for 15 plus years, about 42% get merged, and the rest get delisted. You know, so by and large, survival is rare. Second, you know, barely 30% of companies return the IPO offer price via some kind of fundamentals measure such as earnings. And even there, if you look carefully, it's all by and large driven by M&A, meaning, you know, somebody else basically pays you a control premium and so on. That's what juices up the return. So as a portfolio, if you buy all the M&As that came out, so all the IPOs, I mean, that came out in a year, the only reason you might recover anything close to the offer price at the IPO time is the M&A transaction. So if you delete the M&As, it's pretty hard to even recover the IPO offer price. You know, just fascinating and has all kinds of implications, I think.
Well, Professor, your research paper includes an analysis of Amazon.com. What surprised you the most from your analysis of Amazon?
So we repeated this whole exercise with Amazon as an example. So if you bought Amazon when it went public back in 1997, it turns out that subsequent earnings have indeed repaid the IPO offer price. But if you bought Amazon at the beginning of 1998, 1 year later, you know, we are nowhere close to recovering the purchase price. So through fundamentals. So, you know, we often say with Amazon that, you know, its earnings are right around the corner, or, you know, it's all in the future. But it's remarkable that it's been, something like 20 plus years, and the goalpost keeps changing. So this is the other thing that we discovered. I mean, you have these narratives around these, growth stocks or stocks that are in the news a lot. People always say that earnings are around the corner. You know, but when? It's been like 20 plus years, and we still haven't, you know, as I said, if you bought the stock on 1/1/1998, and the price that you paid has still not come back to you in terms of fundamentals. Now, of course, you can say in the stock market, Amazon is trading at some, you know, amazing price. So that kind of opens up the question, you know, how do we stress test those valuations? You know, are we just trading pieces of paper without, much chance of that actually getting realized through fundamental payoffs? So that's the question that our research tries to raise.
Professor, I found your research findings related to mergers and acquisitions of U.S. public companies particularly interesting. As you know, 2021 was a record year for industrial mergers and acquisitions, including acquisitions of software targets. If I'm a long-term investor, how should I view mergers and acquisitions within my portfolio companies?
Well, if you're skilled enough to predict the firms that will eventually get acquired, identify them, buy them, and hold on to them, because that's where the big payoffs are. And the intuition is fairly simple. If you're a publicly traded company, if somebody else wants to buy you, they have to at least pay you something like a 20 or a 25% control premium beyond the existing stock price. So the payoff to the target company's shareholders is handsome. Now, of course, you know, if somebody is paying money, somebody is actually receiving it. So on the flip side, you wonder about the payoff to the investors of the acquiring company. And again, here, I think there's a lot of work on M&A, which points to the idea that 60 to 70% of M&A transactions, you know, in the long run, don't make money. They don't pay for themselves. So, you know, so if you're a long-term investor, you ideally want to be long in the companies that you think will eventually get acquired. And you probably want to avoid companies that make a lot of acquisitions. Now, not all acquisitions are the same. It's pretty nuanced. You know, we can spend a lot of time discussing the various types of acquisitions, you know, vertical integration, horizontal integration, you're buying human capital. So, you know, there's more nuance there. But big picture, statistically, you know, 60 to 70% of acquisitions don't seem to pay off.
Well, Professor, how about if I'm a federal policymaker considering changes to U.S. antitrust laws related to mergers and acquisitions, or changes to federal securities law rules related to disclosures around mergers and acquisitions? What could I learn from your research in considering the broad economic costs and benefits of rule changes affecting mergers and acquisitions?
So let's start with disclosure. You know, I've often thought that M&A disclosure, if you're a fundamental analyst, is highly inadequate. You know, in general, I don't, beyond the first year, know what the target firm did to my income statement and my balance sheet. In the first year, I know how my revenue changed and my earnings changed. I have a sense for the purchase price paid and the way that was allocated between, you know, intangibles, goodwill, tangibles, and so on. But after the first year, the trail runs cold. I have no idea how the acquisition is actually performing, whether the so-called synergies promised by management are actually showing up in the numbers. So I've written about this quite extensively. You know, if I were the czar who could write the rule and get anything passed, I'd say that take every big acquisition, you know, big defined based on some threshold, and disclose that big acquisition as though it were a separate segment on the income statement and the balance sheet. So I, as an investor, can track whether, you know, the so-called synergies are actually panning out. What are the incremental revenues being added by, say, the target company? If you pick Amazon and Whole Foods, you know, after the first year, I don't know what Whole Foods really did to Amazon. My guess is that it's been pretty much a neutral acquisition. It didn't add a lot or didn't take away a lot. But how would I know that? It's a Herculean task for me as an investor to kind of understand that. So I think there's a fairly big disclosure failure in the world of M&A, and I would push for something like segment disclosure for big M&As. Now, let's talk a little bit about the antitrust idea. The antitrust idea is kind of complicated, and let's pick technology as an example because that's in the news. Before we can even answer the question of how much money does a tech company make, you have to deal with a whole bunch of reporting problems. You know, as you know, internally created intangibles are expensed. And for an Amazon or an Apple or a Microsoft, you know, you have years of that expensing to deal with. So if you correct for those things, and we've done that in a couple of other papers, it turns out that the highest operating return is actually made not by tech companies in the last 30, 40 years. It's healthcare. So the big operating returns after correcting for intangibles reporting and so on is probably in the world of healthcare. And healthcare hasn't gotten as much antitrust attention as it probably should, whereas tech has, for political reasons, I think both sides of the aisle have their beef with tech. So tech has gotten a bit more attention. So, but antitrust is deeply complicated, right? Because one of the things that I don't fully know how to deal with, and I'm not sure the regulators do either, is that the innovator, the person who actually comes up with an innovation, ends up retaining a very small portion of the value that the innovation adds to society. So for instance, whoever came up with the Xerox machine probably retained a very small portion of the value that, Xeroxing added to our lives. Instead of transcribing sheets of paper over and over again, or even Steve Jobs, if you might think of that, the value that Steve Jobs captured because of the iPhone, design and creation, it's probably a minuscule, a tiny portion of the value added to the whole app ecosystem and society in general. So how do you account for that? Because you'd also worry about social return. And that's what makes antitrust quite complicated.
That concludes our podcast episode. On behalf of the Council of Institutional Investors, I want to thank Professor Shivaram Rajapal of Columbia Business School. If you have any questions or comments regarding this podcast, please feel free to contact me at Jeff, JEFF@CII.org. Till next time, I'm Jeff Mahoney. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Voice of Corporate Governance, brought to you by the Council of Institutional Investors. The Voice of Corporate Governance is a free, non-sponsored podcast that highlights critical developments in corporate governance and other important issues affecting institutional investors. The views expressed by those interviewed on the podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of CII or its members. For more information on CII and its policies on corporate governance, please visit our website at www.cii.org.